Thank you. Shelley Stein.
As we talk about this, I keep asking myself, we're talking about this because what's broken? I think as I listen to the conversation around here, you know, I think that the audit, the current auditing and quality control and related professional practice standards include sufficient direction regarding the supervision of work, and I think that failures in this area are because of failures to implement the standards, not a failure in the standards themselves. And I don't think that that's what we're actually talking about here. What I hear the conversation going is, okay, now go beyond the audit team itself. And I know that the firms have policies and procedures in place. So my question is, have there been tons and tons of failures in this area that we're looking at that we need to have rules put in place, or is this something that we could have the benefit of the PCOB through its inspections share the best practice of the other firms that some things could be strengthened? Because I think that every auditor, when they get up and they get involved in an audit engagement, do feel that sense of responsibility. So I'm just not sure where we're going here or what we're trying to accomplish. Maybe a little better for clarification would help, because I think assistance with best practices from the PCOB would be true.
Charlie Niemeyer.
I'm not a broker-dealer expert, but I understand that if FINRA were to be enforcing the activities within a particular broker-dealer, they would apply not only the rules and regulations, but the particular procedures of that broker-dealer firm. We don't do that. We may ask as a part of inspections for the policies of the firm and ask whether there's documentation to support compliance with that. But as far as enforcement, we enforce compliance with PCOB standards. And I guess one of the things that, as a board member, I'd be interested in is comments about whether or not what we're really being asked to do in Sarbanes-Oxley is to go beyond what's in the standards today. Granted, the procedures are in place, especially with larger firms, that may adequately address this. But again, that's not something that's in our standards or that we would enforce against.
Barbara Roper.
I listen to the comments and I hear this concern expressed that people are going to be held accountable for things they didn't know about and didn't have any way of knowing about. And as I heard what Professor Coffey said, he made it fairly clear that if you have appropriate procedures in place and if you're following those procedures and if you've delegated that appropriately, and you don't have reason to believe they're not functioning, you're not on the hook. So this notion that you're automatically accountable all the way up the line for something that you couldn't have known doesn't seem to be as real a concern, I think, as being expressed. And I can assure you in the broker-dealer context that every time a registered rep goes out and defrauds a client, the CEO of the firm isn't suddenly on the hook for that conduct. If there were red flags that the branch manager missed, the branch manager may be on the hook. I mean, the supervisory responsibility and accountability has seemed to function fairly reasonably in that environment of going to the person who really, if there's someone there who should have known that something was going wrong, who exercises that responsibility. The other thing I would say is, that, you know, in terms of sort of where, what the people at the top would be responsible for, certainly that step of making sure the procedures are in place, a robust supervisory system is in place, and that it's being delegated appropriately and that there's reason to believe it's being followed would seem to be something that they are on the hook for. The other point, I think, is that, and certainly this is true in the broker-dealer context, not all problems come from the bottom up. You know, a lot of the bad things that happen in broker-dealer offices happen as company policy. And, you know, when Prudential was selling limited partnerships, it wasn't that the registered reps of the firm suddenly staged some kind of revolution and started pushing these products out to their clients. It was the policy of the firm to push them. And having that kind of accountability up the ladder and holding people responsible up the ladder for policies that they're pushing down the line should be relevant to that supervisory function. And I would suggest that in, say, Arthur Andersen in the Enron case, there may be an analogy there that the elevation of pulling in consulting business, you know, as a company policy is something that the higher up should have been held accountable for and was a red flag, you know, produced some red flags in the context of how decisions were made around that audit that ought to be addressed in a strong supervisory policy.
Give a 10-second response. Accurately stated what broker-dealer law is, but I also would point to you that it's even clearer under the language of Sarbanes-Oxley, because Sarbanes-Oxley, to give you a defense as an associated person, would require both an adequate system of procedures and controls, which could be the international control system. I have no brief one way or the other on the adequacy of that. But point two is whether or not the individual had reasonable cause to believe that such procedures and systems were being complied with. That's not your strict liability. Did you have reasonable cause to believe that the perfectly adequate international system was not being complied with? That I think is the zone that you may want to address. What happens when that particular warning signal comes to you and you're aware of irregularity even under an adequate system that's internationally accepted?
Bob Tirola.
Thank you. I find this question intriguing, and I think it is an interesting one for the board to try to tackle. I used to be an auditor, and in those days, it was pretty much the buck stopped at the audit partner, and you sought consultation when you thought you needed to, and the only rule was you were autonomous, but you didn't have the right to be wrong. Now it's more of a team effort. I think it's a better model, but I'm not sure how the board gets comfort that the tone at the top is right, that span of control is effective, that delegations of authority are working, and that communication systems are effective both ways. I tried to analogize this to the corporate world. Sarbanes-Oxley imposed quite a rigid structure in the corporate world where the CEO, CFO certifies that everything's working, including certainly controls around financial reporting, but make no mistake that runs through how the business works day to day and whether or not it's effective and who's accountable for what. Perhaps there is some analogy there. Perhaps there is some way to formalize more than already exists that clear indication of span of control, delegations of authority, and accountability.
Cindy Richson.
I would just like to respond to Charles Niemeyer's question that he posed to us, is should there be a PCAOB standard on this responsibility as opposed to implementation of the individual audit firm's individual policies. And I think that it makes sense for the PCAOB to have the core principles embodied in a PCAOB standard, and then if the firms want to implement sort of best practices, and I mean PCAOB is in a good situation because they can inspect and ask for copies of the firm details and documents, and so PCAOB can, you know, constantly be revising and making sure it has the highest standard or principles, core principles in its standard. But I think there needs to be consistency here where there's sort of at least a floor of what is expected on this issue, and then firms on a voluntary private basis are allowed to, you know, create best practices and continuously improve in this area.
David Becker.
I just want to act like a lawyer a little bit here and emphasize the sort of the boundaries of what we're talking about. We're not talking about in the air whether it's a good idea for some people to be responsible if things go wrong. We're talking about implementation of a particular statute. And The statute requires, in the first instance, a violation by someone, that is, say, a violation of law. And in the second instance, in order for there to be supervisory liability imposed on a person, the person who violates the law has to be subject to the supervision of the person on whom supervisory liability is imposed. And one of the things that I'm learning from the discussion around the table here, is that it's anything but self-evident in the context of an accounting organization as to who supervises whom and what is meant by supervision. I can tell you in the broker-dealer context, organizations go through a certain number of contortions to make clear who is supervising whom and more particularly who is not supervising whom, so that among other things you can have a system for consultation on legal and compliance matters that doesn't make the people who consult necessarily supervisors. So I do think that it is useful for the board to, because the statute's there, to make clear who is a supervisor, what constitutes supervision in this context.
Thank you. Pat Harned? I guess one of the things that concerns me as I've listened to you talk is that we've seen nationally when we've asked employees what they see happening at work, that when employees witness a violation, 42% of them don't do anything about it. They don't tell the supervisor, they don't report it higher up within their organization. But when they do, they generally will go to their immediate supervisor. And if they can't go to their immediate supervisor, they go to another person within management. And so if you're going to narrow the definition of who is your supervisor to an engagement partner, in a lot of ways, it's entirely possible that employees are going elsewhere within an organization to get guidance, to get help when they need it. But to add to that a little bit, in listening to you talk about tone at the top, is sort of an interesting thing. When you have employees in an organization who perceive that there is good tone at the top, meaning from the leaders of the organization, they're emphasizing the importance of standards and integrity in doing business, and they're providing resources and talking about those things, you see misconduct being reduced by as much as 50%. But when you ask employees who's the tone at the top coming from, very often they're thinking of somebody within their local organization, a person who's immediately above them or maybe two levels above them. So I think in trying to get your arms around who's a supervisor, what is the tone at the top and how does it work, it really is very much a part of the culture of the organization. It is something that can be quantified. It is something that can be encouraged. I'm just not convinced that it's encouraged by creating a specific rule. It's encouraged by helping people to see the value of it by studying best practices. But again, I don't think it's possible to overstate the importance of a supervisor in encouraging integrity among people. Thank you. Larry Salva.
Thanks. I'm not an attorney, but I got the same impression that David pointed out, that the statute authorizes sanctions on the firm or supervisory personnel if a supervised person commits the violation. So you have to have the violation first. And Charlie's point was, do we need a standard that, you know, helps people understand who the supervisory people are that might be subject to those sanctions? I think that was the question that was asked. And I'm not sure that you can have I guess my concern is the one size fits all. There's so many different quality control procedures that might be put into place for different size firms, different organizations. It will probably only become evident in the determination of the facts that existed in a particular set of circumstances, whether someone was supervised and whether that supervisor failed to perform duties that they were responsible for within that context of that firm and that situation. I would think, I might be wrong on this, but it seems like the board has the authority to impose that sanction, whether there's a standard or not. And I'm not sure why a standard would help. In fact, I think it might constrain by, you know, for the different size of the firms that exist and the different structures that they might put into place. My own experience, you know, when I was in public accounting, was that I did have responsibility for certain aspects of risk and quality, and at times I could engage in discussions or make recommendations as to whether a particular partner needed either additional backup, et cetera. Once I did that, once I became aware of that, I felt like I was part of the supervisory structure. But I could make a recommendation that might not be followed, and then the choice was to me as to where else do I go. Once I've made that recommendation and it's not followed, do I have another source to go to, another, you know, higher up, if you will? I reported to an audit practice partner. I also reported up to a risk, national risk leader. If I failed in my duties to supervise in terms of assignment or performance of engagement partners, then I felt like in that circumstance I should be held accountable. But I'm not sure that that structure exists in every firm. So if you found that one of my supervised individuals created a violation, I would think that in that circumstance you would find, and potentially impose sanctions on me for my failure to supervise.
Joe Carcello.
I think this topic, as a number of others have said, really kind of cuts across not just supervision but culture. And I think in many ways that's maybe the more important issue. And let me elaborate just a little bit on that. The board may be looking at these things as part of the inspection process, but if they're not, I'd encourage them to at least think about it. Let me give you a few examples. Let's say I'm the managing partner of a firm in Nashville, and I'm highly dependent on a particular client, and I lose that client, and now I have a lot of staff who are less than fully chargeable. So I start bidding for work at a significant discount from what other firms are charging. We all know that that type of behavior has happened in the past. That sends a powerful message to the people in your organization as to what the firm leadership values, and that affects behavior. Advertising language, this was replete throughout the 90s. It used to make me almost physically sick walking through airports and seeing some of the advertising slogans of the major firms. They've wised up, but you still see some of the regional firms who are registered with you, who do inspect public companies with slogans like, "We partner with you for success." That affects how the people in the firm who do the work day in and day out think about what's valued. The background of office managing partners, where are they coming from? Are they primarily business development people, or are they primarily people who come from a field background? Who is on the firm's managing committee? Consulting services granted not provided for audit clients still continue to grow, growing very rapidly in a lot of the firms. And so who's on the managing committee? Is it the audit people? And is it really an audit firm, or is it a professional services firm? And I know the board talks to people on engagements as part of the inspection process, but my understanding is they talk to people who are still in the firm, and they talk to people together. Well, if you put me in a room with three or four other people, and some of the people in that room are my superior, I'm not sure I'm going to be completely candid with you. So if you really want to understand the culture inside the firm, you need to talk to people one-on-one. And I would suggest you need to talk to some subset of people who've left the firm. Now, if one or two of them indicate that there's a problem with the culture and you've talked to a large number, they could just be bitter people who've left the firm. But if you get a consistent message about problems with the culture of that organization from people who've left the firm, in all likelihood, there's a lot of validity to that message. So these are all things that culture, which I think in many ways, I think if you look at the problems we had earlier this decade, it wasn't necessarily that standards were fundamentally flawed. It was the implementation of standards. And that a lot of times that ties back to the culture inside the organization.
Thank you. Lynn Turner.
Just listening to a couple people, two other thoughts that came up to consider. First of all, Jack made a very important point about the need for compliance the way SOX is written. And that notion was actually came out of the auditor independence rules that had been drafted not too soon before that, that said if you've got this quality control process in place, then and you're actually doing it, you get a pass. And you get a pass for everyone up the ladder. But if you don't haven't gone through that process, then you're into the penalty box. And that's where that notion, I can tell you, that's where that notion came from. The other thing was the inspections in the testimony that had occurred during the hearings. One thing that came out was the inspections up to that point in time in the peer review process had all been inspection against the firm's own quality control processes and standards. It had not been against what should have been the standard or what best practices was. It's just that the old peer review went in and said, if this is what you have in your firm manual, have you been doing what's in your firm manual? And as we all know, there were some serious shortcomings in what was in those firm manuals, and they never got up to best practice, and the POB was never able to lift them. If you can get firms to get up to best practices in their own standards, then it probably doesn't become that big an issue. But if you have trouble getting firms to get to the level of quality control that you really think you ought to be inspecting against, and this is the same issue we're having with the credit rating agencies today, the exact same issue, then you've got to write your own standard. And the real question becomes, how do you get those firms to that top-notch quality control such that those of us on the investing side are getting the right numbers out of the process? And so I think it is a significant issue as to whether you go against just the firms and they control the process, or you go against your own standard where you establish it. But if you establish your own standards, I'd also tell you, you ought to be looking at what each of the firms have, because they typically have best practices amongst themselves, and it's real, can you pull all the best practices together and really create a really top-notch quality control and get them all on board at that point in time.
Thank you. Bob Kippers.
I think what Patricia mentioned was particularly important, and I would observe the tone at the top as a matter of perspective. If you're at the top of the firm, it means one thing, but if you're a staff person in the Midwest, the top of the firm to you is the audit leader in Columbus or the managing partner in Des Moines, and those are the people that you look to for guidance. I think it is also true that the firms universally, and I can't speak for 800, but if you speak for the seven or eight largest firms, have developed alternate mechanisms to raise concerns or questions about quality. You know, hotlines, ethics programs. If you're not comfortable with your supervisor, there are strong encouragement to raise those concerns through sometimes even an anonymous route, trying to draw out any concerns our people have, and that's what our clients have gone through certainly since many years ago when we had the scandal. So I think there are good mechanisms in place. But having listened to Joe and a number of others, I was hoping to kind of nail this, tie it up, and go to lunch early. Because the ISQC-1 that we keep referring to, just a couple of words for you, you know, requires the firm to establish the procedures and policies necessary to promote an internal culture based on the recognition that quality is essential to the performance of engagements, and goes on to vest the responsibility for that with either the CEO of the firm or its board of managing partners as appropriate. So I do think, you know, I'm starting to repeat myself, but I think that looking at that seems to cover a lot of the comments we heard today, and I just want to point out that it does actually speak to culture, and as Vin said, many of the firms are already taking responsibility for ISQC-1, even though it isn't really part of your interim standards at this point.
Thank you. Arnie Hanisch.
Bob, usually you and I agree on a number of things, but in all due respect, if I was to take your last comment and apply that to tone at the top within an organization, a company, then that means that my salesperson
out in the field, the tone is going to be set by their district manager or regional manager, and I don't think that's within keeping with the spirit of Sarbanes-Oxley. Tone at the top starts at the CEO of an organization. It's not out with some person in Des Moines, Iowa, who's looking at their office managing partner. And if we don't set the right tone within our own organization at the top, at the top of an organization, I mean, it's there's a challenge and a problem there. So I certainly hope that you didn't mean what you said. And in all due respect, Bob.
I was only saying it's a matter of perspective for our young people. The CEO in New York is too distant.
Yeah, but you know, we got people all over the world to work for our company, and by God, the tone at the top is with our CEO. And regardless of whether they work in China as a salesperson or a rep or wherever they may work, the tone gets set at the top, and then there's multiple tones that get set based upon the layers within an organization. So I in all due respect, Bob.
I'll let Professor Coffey make a few remarks.
I've been asked to say a few things that may or may not relate to what's been going on, and I don't mean to tell you that broker-dealer regulation should control auditing regulation. I would suggest, however, that we're dealing with two professions in both cases, and there are some similarities. And in particular, when we look at what the duty to supervise is, David Becker was quite right. There has to be a violation, but it doesn't have to be a violation of law. The exact language of Sarbanes-Oxley is that if there's been a violation of a professional standard. So if you think even though you have a perfect system, there has been shortcoming in terms of your compliance of personnel with professional standards, not involving a legal violation, that is the circumstance where there is an obligation and where the affirmative defense would not apply. So I just want to keep us focused on not thinking simply about violations of law, but violations of professional standards. That's where there is going to be a duty to show you had no reasonable cause to believe that there was a violation of a professional standard. Okay.
We'd like to move on to the next discussion topic because it does relate to broker-dealers, and we've talked about how that was considered in connection with developing Sarbanes-Oxley and whether or not that model is appropriate in the context of the accounting firms. So just wanted to ask that question directly to get some direct feedback on that point, and some of you have commented on that already, but I'd be interested in other views on this to help us inform where we should go in our standard settings. Wayne Collins?
A couple points here. One is looking at the broker-dealer, it's a summary of the broker-dealer standard that was handed out, the NASDAQ Rule 3010. One of the items is assignment of each registered rep to an appropriately registered representative and or principals which shall be responsible for supervising that person's activities. Seems like that's more of almost a real-time type of monitoring, and almost a one-to-one type of monitoring, which is different from the way that audits are conducted and the hierarchy of the accounting firms. So I wanted that element to be considered in any kind of analogous approach that's being used. And there was a point that was raised before about situation where if a partner who is consulted on an engagement provides that partner's view, and that view is not carried out by the engagement team, could the consulted partner be held responsible? I mean, if there are, it seems to me, if there are mechanisms within that firm for a disagreement to be expressed up the chain, and that partner expresses his disagreement because the engagement team didn't follow it, then that partner has followed the appropriate policies, and that partner should not be held accountable.
Randy Fletchall.
Jennifer, I meant to go back and actually look at the broker-dealer rules. I confess I did not do so, so I went back and looked at our firm's comment letter on the board's proposed rule on investigations and adjudications back in August of 2003. At the time, said we certainly understand and appreciate the board needing to deal with the ability to supervise and the responsibility to supervise, but did not think you should just look to the broker-dealer framework as the right answer, that we thought there were very many structural differences between the two professions. And so I would just repeat, I guess, in the specific to your question, you know, it's fine to look at, but we don't think that would be the answer, and you need to go further than look at broker-dealer as an example.
Any other comments on this topic? Everybody hungry? All right, I'm going to move on to the next one, which I think we've received a lot of great feedback. So this last discussion topic is whether the current auditing quality control and related professional practice standards include sufficient direction concerning supervision of audit work. And as I said, we've heard a lot of discussion already, which relates to this question. So if there's anything else that anyone wants to add on this point. See Bob Dacey.
Thanks. Just a couple observations, and I refer back to what John Tellis has said earlier, is that if you're looking at implementing a process, particularly with firms that maybe public companies are a small part of their practice, you have to be careful about how consistent you are with other standards. So I think if you look at this, you need to be careful that we have the same issue when we issue our government auditing standards on the yellow book and have to be very careful not to create two separate quality assurance processes going on within a firm, because that can tend to be confusing. In terms of what standards are out there, again, I just defer back to the inspection process as to whether or not there's evidence in terms of engagement reviews as to whether there are problems with what's been documented in the way of supervision. In our earlier discussion, we were talking about Section 105 of the Act, and in effect there were positive steps an entity could take, and it's in their best interest to take, to create these policies and procedures which can be used as a defense if there's an issue at hand. But when it comes to actual standards of supervision and the audit engagements, I just again would throw that back to the board as to what kinds of things are being found in audits related to supervision issues on engagements. Thanks.
I don't know if any of our board members want to comment back or not at this point. Okay. David Silvers?
I'm concerned, I think, about the nature of the discussion in this group in relation to this question. I don't think there's any doubt but what there's some difference in history and culture and organizational structure between broker-dealers and audit firms, at least between some broker-dealers and some audit firms. The history of the large retail houses is really a history of a sort of command and control organization. Audit firms have their roots in actual partnerships, but on the other hand, there are broker-dealers that were really partnerships at one time or another. Most of them have since become far larger, again, sort of more centralized organizations. If the question is really about the approach and attitude of the board in conducting its inspections and its supervisory role, It troubles me that there's any disagreement about, for example, the question that Arnie was being rather insistent about, that tone at the top means tone at the top, not tone in the middle. I didn't come to this conversation thinking there was any disagreement about that. I think that similarly, I think most investors would feel that there should be some obligation in an audit firm of all places to on the part of all those involved in the chain of command, to act on, and I've forgotten the term of art in Jack's paper, but to act on the suspicious circumstance that has come to their attention. That just feels to me like the right thing. I still don't know, based on this conversation, whether that idea is currently embodied in the standards which the board enforces or which the profession enforces more largely. If it's not, it should be.
Kaylin Hansen.
Lynn mentioned earlier about on the audit report and the fact that the firms sign those. One of the discussions that we've had over at the Treasury Committee is whether audit partners, in fact, should be signing audit reports in addition to the firm's name. And like some of the others have expressed, I grew up in the audit world where the buck did stop with the engagement partner. I think that model has changed over a period of time. There are significant other people in even the smallest of firms, and it's interesting at the state board level when we institute disciplinary proceedings, it's interesting how everyone starts pointing at one another as to who's who told who what and who's responsible. I think some guidance is clearly appropriate in this area, and I believe that there are in any quality organization, you know, situations where things that do go wrong that people beyond the engagement partner have responsibility. That should be clarified to their benefit. I don't think they should be held responsible for things that they don't know about, but I think it should be clarified for everybody's sake.
Thank you. Joe Carcello.
A relatively quick point about the conversation between Arne and Damon and Bob Kiffers. I think anybody, and including Bob, would agree that the tone at the top starts with the CEO, and I don't think he wasn't trying to say that. But that's obviously very important, and no one would dispute that. But if you're a 23-year-old or 24-year-old or 25-year-old out there on an audit, and you've got a senior or a manager who's bucking for the next promotion, and they're primarily feeling pressure to meet the time budget, that affects behavior. So I think both matter.
Thank you. Sam Renzella.
I agree, Joe, and I don't think Bob ever... Bob, he's there. Okay, you're back. Well, let you speak for yourself. To Galen's point, I don't think there's anybody who consults on a technical matter that doesn't think at the end of the day they put their skin in the game. And I don't think this is any – I didn't read this as anything about when somebody directly consults with somebody about a matter that I feel like if I'm the consultee that – it doesn't. I don't really have any skin in the game. I think what this is about the supervision. Well, one, this appears to be more about investigation and enforcement than it is about audit quality. This appears to be an attempt to look for somebody else to charge when you find behavior at the audit partner level or at some other level. And maybe that's a part of audit quality, right? Those might argue that if you think you're going to get charged, maybe your behavior will change. But I think this is more about trying to find that there are quality control standards at the engagement level. Those are baked into the auditing standards. There are quality control standards that deal with the firm and the overall audit practice. And this seems to be looking for some more rules in between the two. And I don't think it's about somebody consulting on a technical matter with the national office and the individual in the national office saying, well, you know, well, whatever, it's the engagement partner's responsibility. Hope it's right, but I don't really care. I can assure you that I have conversations with my children when I get consulted on a matter like that and inform them that things could get very difficult. So I think this is about the supervision as it relates to a broader than a consultation matter. And it's around, I think, the Greg's earlier points, the management around the geography or the industry. And I think the way I would characterize the firms, now there isn't a single individual. It's almost a matrix. And I think Bob tried to explain that earlier, and I might be hacking all over what he tried to explain. But there's somebody that is in the quality control element of the firm. Somebody's looking after the professional practice. Somebody that is working around workload and assignments of individuals and making sure that engagements have the right people on them. They're not necessarily that same human being every time. And it's somewhat of a matrix organization. And at least at the bigger firms, I think that's probably part of the complication. So I don't, I guess I just wanted to relay my thoughts as to what some have said about feeling like you had skin in the game in consultation. I don't think that's what this issue is about.
Sam, can I just ask a follow-up question? You talk about the matrix and the larger firms and the individuals, and Bob also had mentioned an engagement partner may report to three people, one in the geography, one in the industry, and the practice leader. And so kind of under the context of the matrix, is it clear to the engagement partner, is it clear as far as who their responsibility is? How does it reconcile, is, you know, if there's issues that are arrived, how is that reconciled? How does that individual work within that matrix, and is the line, are the lines clear? Because right now our standards are just very generic, you know, to have quality control policies and procedures, but how does, what's the practice of how that operates?
Well, I think each firm, I can only speak for my firm on that particular aspect of it, but there is, I mean, there's constant dialogue between the geographical and a professional practice person in each of the areas to share that information, and one feeds into the other. So I think it's through a matter of consultation and communication among those different members of the matrix.
Cindy Richton. I just wanted to quickly clarify, and I'll defer to John's expert detailed knowledge on this area, but I've heard a number of people say, well, people shouldn't be held responsible for something they don't know. Well, the legal standard, at least in other areas, is know or should have known, given the presence of red flags and your position and authority in the organization. So I just wanted to clarify that if there's a standard, it should be know or should have known. Because what you certainly don't want to do is create a culture of, I hear nothing, I see nothing, I know nothing, because that's the best way to insulate yourself. And the other thing that I've heard around the table is, I understand the matrix, I understand the complexity of the audit firm structures, but what you don't want to wind up with at the end of the day if something goes wrong is all the potential people who are involved in some kind of authoritative position pointing the fingers at each other with no one clearly ultimately responsible for the engagement, because then you wind up with, and I'll borrow my colleague here, Howard Johnson's term, you know, a pile of mush. So somebody does need to be responsible.
You're correct. I'll leave it at that. The exact language is no reasonable cause to believe the system wasn't working. And that means a red flag has told you it's not working the way it's written here on paper.
Bob Kippers.
I'm actually glad I stepped out and missed some things, I think. But what I was attempting to point out, and I was really following up on Patricia's comment, the tone at the top is vital, and I was even proposing a standard that would fix that responsibility with the CEO or the board of partners as appropriate. My point is, if it stops at the top, it's not going to work. If it's not, doesn't cascade down, if it isn't reinforced, particularly in a partnership where a CEO is sort of important, but frankly a fleeting position, people come and go from that, you know, all partners are looked to as leaders by certain of our young people, and from the perspective of a young staff, you know, the distant CEO, that's important, whatever he or she says, but they're going to look to, day in, day out, to the people they view as local leaders to reinforce and have that same culture. So I love the idea of fixing that where it belongs, but I also was just acknowledging that if it doesn't cascade, the organization is dysfunctional and the culture doesn't really work the way it was intended. But thank you for starting that, Arnie. I appreciate it.
Jeff Mahoney.
Professor, since we have you here today, I just wondered, do you have an opinion as to what aspects of the broker-dealer framework would be inappropriate to carry over to the accounting firms?
Very good question, and I'm not thoroughly prepared, but let me just make this simple observation. I think most complex business organizations, and this is the basic doctrine of business schools today, are moving from being strictly hierarchical to more matrix-oriented, so there were multiple people supervising. I think your rules, not necessarily by copying broker-dealer regulation, but your rules should recognize that a matrix system does have multiple supervisors. It's not strictly linear. And I leave you with that thought.
Dick Dietrich.
I come back to Greg Jonas's point, and apropos talking for others, let me see if I can speak for Greg here. It struck me that what I understood Greg's comments to be were that the partner in charge of the audit has pressures that he or she faces. Those pressures are primarily, I think, one of resources available to that partner to conduct the audit that may be outside of the audit partner's control, and second, the performance evaluation of the audit partner by others in the organization. So this is outside of my realm of expertise, but my question then is, are those individuals covered now in the context of supervisory through the QC standards?
I'm sorry, I was looking at 10 cards. Your question was directed to me, is that correct? It just is whether these individuals are covered in the QC standards?
Sure.
Well, as indicated in our briefing paper, the QC standards do provide some direction at a very high level. Very high, you know, the firm management should have something and the firm can figure it out. But as far as having further direction, like in the broker-dealer environment and kind of clearly articulating more of what supervision means and who may be responsible in firm management, it is very different from that context.
Yeah, and I think, again, back to what I understood Greg's comment to be, is that if we think about it from the incentives of the individual who's making the judgments, right, how do we make that work well? Well, to the extent that that person's judgments are influenced by others in supervisory roles, in performance evaluation roles, or those that are providing resources to that individual that's responsible for the audit, it strikes me that they ought to be somehow more explicitly recognized as having a supervisory role in a matrix function. And I think that clarifying that would go a long way to making clear to people, although it may not get to Ms. Richin's preference that there be specific responsibility assigned to individuals, I think then you could get to a reasonably clear set of at least culprits that would be in the room for discussion.
Thank you. Looks like Gary Kubrick, you have the last word on this subject.
Oh, okay. I don't know if that's good or bad, but thank you. This is from a preparer perspective. First of all, I think there is a need, some standard or some guidance, but at the moment I don't actually purport to say what it should be, but just maybe a few preparer concerns. And one is on the timing and getting decisions. Let's say you come up with some standard or rule that sweeps in the risk partners or the national office partners into the mix here, and that somehow either actually or perceptively they think they've got more skin in the game under your revised rules than they did today. What I would be worried about is, one is the timing of audit decisioning. I mean, the more people that get a vote in the action, slow things up. And as from a client point of view, you've got 30 days to get a 10Q out the door. You've got 6 days to get a 10K and so on. So you're looking for, you know, relatively timely decisioning. I think if the consulting partners view that they've got more skin in the game, I think it's going to slow things up. They have a concern about the authority of the engagement partner. So you're going to ask who's making, you know, the decision for the team. So I would be concerned about who you're speaking to. A lot of times the consulting partners, people you don't know. I mean, they're a national office, their name. And if they perceive themselves potentially more at risk, I would wonder what would be in it for them to give you anything but a reasonably conservative answer, the engagement team. Then how does the engagement partner balance that? Because he's the one to face the client. Just one other comment. I mean, when we get every year, get our audit plan presented to our board and stuff, our current firm or former firms, call the big grid chart of all these consulting partners, national office partners that are engaged, we can call. I think that might be a starting point for who is a supervisor, because for the most part, you don't see these people, and you might know the names, and from time to time, the name will come up on it, but usually there's a lot of partners, you know, that are outside the engagement team that are presented to your board, at least on a chart. And if you want to start, where do you begin? Maybe that's the place.
Thank you. Thank you all very much for your feedback during this discussion, and I want to give a special thanks to Professor Coffey for his participation. It's been incredibly helpful.
Okay, great. We're going to break for lunch now. We do have lunch for our SAG members, our official observers, and panelists who are here today, as well as PCAOB board members and staff upstairs. We will reconvene here at 1:30. Thank you.